This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear about a stunning victory for Black and Latino firefighters.
It's taken 40 years, but finally, in a city that's 50% Black and Latino, the fire department may soon reflect its population.
In what is clearly a case of harassment, lawyers for the Roman Catholic Church are going after a group called SNAP, Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests.
Instead of putting an end to abuse by priests, instead of getting priests prosecuted, what do? They harass the survivors and advocates for those who have suffered abuse.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Heidi, for years we've been covering the outrageous treatment in the case of the Cuban Five. And I'm sure all our listeners are familiar with the five that have been convicted and imprisoned for many years in jail. One is out on parole in Florida now, but it's a many-year case. I know we have an update, particularly with regard to Rene Gonzalez, who's one of the five who was actually paroled but forced to live in Miami for the 3 years of parole.
That's right, Michael. Rene Gonzalez has actually been forced to serve his time on probation in the U.S. rather than being allowed to return to his homeland. This despite the fact that his brother Roberto, his only sibling, is gravely ill with cancer in a Havana hospital.
Now hold up for a second. That's Roberto Gonzalez, is Rene Gonzalez's brother. He's a lawyer in Havana. And I think just as an aside here, not such an aside, you actually met Roberto Gonzalez a few years ago in Havana. Is that right?
I did. Actually, I've met him a couple of times, but had a meeting with him when I went down with a few guild attorneys, and we met with members of the family of the five to see what we could do to help raise awareness of their case in the U.S. The disturbing news is that the government is not allowing Rene to go back to Cuba to see his brother. So the National Lawyers Guild...
Now wait, this is not like Rene is in prison and asking to visit his dying brother and only sibling. Rene is living in Florida on probation.
That's right.
And they still won't let him go back for the visit.
Clearly a political move.
And he should have never been left in Florida to begin with. I mean...
No, and this is, I think, not strange given the history of this government making it difficult, if not impossible, for members of the family to visit the five during their incarceration and continued incarceration for the rest of them in maximum security facilities in the U.S. But the Guild has made Roberto an honorary member in recognition of his many contributions as a human rights defender and in particular his efforts on behalf of the Cuban Five, because as you mentioned, he's a member of the legal team. Rene had recently petitioned the court to allow him to return to Cuba for 2 weeks and was turned down. So what we're trying to do, and the Committee to Free the Five and others are trying to raise awareness and pressure the government by sending letters. It's truly a humanitarian act, actually a failure on the part of our government to act in a humanitarian fashion.
It just shows the cruelty, the utter cruelty of this government, not only imprisoning the five who were trying to stop terrorism against their homeland, Cuba, but then in carrying out their sentences, the cruelty, but of course we see that cruelty in any, with regard to a number of prisoners who the U.S. wants to get, whether it's Bradley Manning or the Guantanamo people or people in solitaire all over. But it is an outrage in this case.
Who do you write to, Heidi?
We're calling on members of the public to write to Secretary of State Clinton. Michael, we'll put a link on our website to a number of individuals in the government that people can write to, fax, or call.
LawandDisorder.org.
You know, when I thought about the story, Heidi, when you said you wanted to talk about it here, you know, I thought about it. I have a brother, Michael has brothers, and you think about how close we are to our siblings, and the idea that one could be dying in another country, and that I'm walking the streets of Miami on probation, and I couldn't get back to really embrace him, and I haven't seen him for many years because I've been in jail, assuming I'm Rene, many years. I mean, it just shows
a cruelty that goes, it's inexplicable. It's not inexplicable. It just goes beyond any words I have.
Well, Michael, the road to this latest cruelty was paved the way when they wouldn't allow the wives and the family of the five to come visit him. It was all done on the pretext that they were spies. And this latest cruelty is done on the pretext that spying effort of the Cubans will be carried on if they allow one brother to see another brother. And the irony is that what the Cuban five were trying to do was prevent terrorism launched from Miami against the island. They were the ones that compiled the information on who the terrorists were. The United States turned around and called them people who are conspiring to spy on the United States and put them in prison. So it's not only cruel, the irony is, you know, very deep.
Michael, you spent a week in Florida for the hunger strike by the Immokalee workers.
Well, I only spent a few days, and when I got to Florida, it was at Lakeland, Florida, and it was a big hunger strike by scores of people, many of the Immokalee workers themselves, many of their supporters, and it was carried out in Lakeland, Florida, in front of the Publix headquarters. Publix is the biggest chain of supermarkets in Florida and in the Southeast. The Coalition of Immokalee Workers, which are tomato pickers, have already won against many other chains, a penny a pound, ending abuse in the fields. They've won against Taco Bell, McDonald's, Trader Joe's, Whole Foods, etc. And now they're taking on Publix, which is a very right-wing, ideological, non-public corporation. A toughie, but I'm convinced they'll win. So I get down to Lakeland with a number of other people. And the first thing you see, of course, if you look across the lake, we're not too close to Publix, we're across a small lake, there's a big surveillance truck sitting there run by Publix, which apparently has incredibly sophisticated equipment so that if I'm having a conversation, you know, 500 yards away, that truck can pick it up. So they're pulling out all the stops at Publix. And of course, there's...
And plus, having the truck there itself is creates a chilling effect on your right to assemble.
When we talked to each other, we had to either turn our backs or move away, even though it's, you know, it's quite far away. I mean, 500 yards away at least, but you still had to do that. And when you got there, I'd got there only about the third or fourth day of the hunger strike, and the other people have already been on it for 4 days. When I said already on it, the first thing that happened is my son Jake Ratner, who works there, comes up to me and ties a yellow ribbon around my arm, indicating that I'm on a hunger strike at least for less than the 6 days. The other people have a white ribbon. I was given a yellow
meaning
ribbon.
Meaning they're full-timers.
Right. And so I did very well on the hunger strike. I got there at about 10 in the morning. And at 4, they take one of the vans that's sort of distant from the whole set of people. And they serve pizza in the back for people who are not on the hunger strike. So my wife is there and a couple of other friends. They go to the pizza van, but I have this yellow band on me. So I say, okay, I'll just go watch what they're doing at the pizza van. And of course, my hunger strike was over. I basically lasted from lunch till 4 o'clock.
Oh, Michael, what kind of an activist are you?
I do better here in New York between lunch and dinner. So that was my part of the hunger strike. We don't have all day to talk about this here, but it was an incredibly moving experience to be there. And of course, the big day was Saturday when they did a 3-mile march from one Publix supermarket back to Publix headquarters. And there were over 1,000 of us massed in front of a Publix supermarket 3 miles away. And when people tried to park their cars in the parking lot, they had many Publix guards out there who said your cars will be towed away. So as someone tweeted me, they have plenty of money to tow your car away, but not enough to pay a penny a pound. Now, when you think about a penny a pound, you know, Publix is huge. This is one product. It's tomatoes. The amount of money is minuscule for them. I mean, not minuscule. I mean, it's zero. And so what it is, it's an ideology of a right wing that says we are not going to bend to workers at all. We want all the power to make every decision. That's what it is, plain and simple. They will bend in the end. I mean, we're all confident of that because their brand, Publix, which has this incredible slogan under it, I forgot about how wonderful they are, is getting
probably
hit.
Probably serving the public.
I was in Florida 2 months ago. I shot that Publix as a mediocre supermarket.
Anyway, it's there. So the march was amazing. And even though I'm no necessarily big fan of everything the Kennedys do, three of the Kennedys came to the march in front of Publix. And that actually was incredibly moving. And they came there on Saturday, and it was the 44th anniversary, the 44th anniversary of Bobby Kennedy breaking the fast with Cesar Chavez at United Farm Workers in California.
Amazing.
And there you have Bobby Jr. in front of us talking about what his father did. You had Carrie Kennedy, and then you had the mother, Ethel Kennedy, in a wheelchair she came. And she's sitting there talking about the importance of farm worker organizing, people who are protected by no law at all, none, no union law, anything. It's the hardest to organize transient population, and the Kennedys really brought people to tears. And as I'm marching on this 3-mile march, which is very hot, two things occurred. One is there are these banners that are placed over the sidewalk you walk underneath, which gave the history of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. The first one starts off with a man named Lucas Benitez, who was arguably was one of the founders, just completely bloodied. I mean, just bloodied completely in 1996, when he's beaten up by the growers or by the thugs of the growers. And that's what was the beginning of the coalition. Well, I don't think that happens anymore. And the other thing, of course, that was incredibly moving, about a mile and a half into my walk, I see Ethel Kennedy in her wheelchair going along, this 80-some-year-old woman. I mean, it was, wow, you know, really moving. Look, the Kennedys are a mixed bag in many, many respects. But on this farm worker issue, I think particularly because of the historical legacy of Bobby Kennedy and the farm workers, they were great. Then we got to the main place where all the music went on, and they had a very famous singer I didn't know called Jose Jose, who's like the most famous singer in Latin America. I mean, he's older now, so he didn't sing, but he was there. And then you had these very small children, 3-4 years old, carrying bread, who were the children of the Immokalee workers. Just beautiful kids, you know, tense faces in a way, and going up on the stage, bringing bread, because that was the sixth day when they were breaking the fast. If it ever happens again, I just would encourage all our listeners to get to wherever Immokalee Workers is doing events like this, because if you want to have faith in what can be done, you can see what these, really the poorest of the poor. And Lucas Benitez, the man who'd been beaten, was on the stage, and I'll end with this. He said, here I am, Lucas Benitez, poor, really, Mexican, with other Central Americans. I'm standing on a stage with the most influential, one of the most influential families in America. I mean, it's remarkable the journey we have taken as Immokalee workers. So it was a very, very beautiful event, and really glad I went there. I would encourage our listeners to go to the CIW website, put in CIW. You'll find videos that were actually made by my son Jake and his partner Elena that are absolutely moving. The last one on the sixth day, just 2 minutes, is just terrific. There's photographs, there's all the statements. And when I was there, Jake had gotten in touch with Tom Morello, who was a big supporter of the farm workers. And I'm there, and I just get a tweet, which everybody did who follows CIW, on tweets from Tom Morello saying they've won before, they're going to win again. And so all that is just, it was a very, very encouraging 3 or 4 days. Last week, the Center for Constitutional Rights filed a federal lawsuit against Abiding Truth Ministries President Scott Lively. The case was filed on behalf of Sexual Minorities Uganda, a nonprofit umbrella organization for LGBT advocacy groups in Uganda. The suit alleged that Lively, who lives in the United States, is involved in anti-gay efforts in Uganda, including his active participation in the formulation of anti-gay legislation and policies aimed at revoking fundamental rights from LGBT persons, and constitutes persecution. It's the first known alien tort case seeking accountability for persecution on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. Uganda's parliament has a pending bill, commonly known as the, quote, Kill the Gays Bill, that provides the death penalty for, quote, homosexuality, prison for failing to turn in someone suspected of being, quote, homosexual, and criminalizes advocacy around LGBT rights. As Pam Spees, a senior staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, said, Lively has been the man with the plan in this enterprise. He long ago set out a very specific and detailed methodology for stripping away the most basic human rights protections to silence and ultimately disappear LGBT people. Unfortunately, he found willing accomplices and fertile ground in Uganda. The executive director of Sexual Minorities Uganda, Frank Mugisha, said, U.S. evangelical leaders like Scott Lively have actively and intensively worked to eradicate any trace of LGBT advocacy and identity. Particularly damaging has been his claim that children are at risk because of our existence. His influence has been incredibly harmful and destructive for LGBT Ugandans. We have to stop people like Scott Lively from helping to codify and give legal cover to hatred. So we'll be following that case as it goes on, again filed by the Center for Constitutional Rights on behalf of the major LGBT group in Uganda. Once again, we want to encourage our listeners to follow Heidi Boghossian and Michael Ratner on their Twitter accounts. Heidi, what is your Twitter?
Occupy Lawyer.
It's at Occupy Lawyer.
Oh, right, at Occupy Lawyer.
And mine, Michael Ratner, is at Just Left, J-U-S-T-L-E-F-T. Now, Heidi and I can't do what Michael Moore is doing. He's offering $1,000 to a donation as a donation. I think it's every 10,000 or every 20,000 people who follow him on Twitter. He's up to close to a million or something. He has some huge number. We're like in the hundreds, maybe.
Well, I don't have any yet, Michael.
Right. So we can't really offer, but we can tell you that the tweets that will come from us. Last week, I was down at Bradley Manning's trial. Heidi follows all of the Guild and Occupy work. There'll be interesting tweets, again.
At Occupy Lawyer.
And at Just Left.
This month, lawyers for the Roman Catholic Church and priests accused of sexual abuse and pedophilia have used the courts to force a group, SNAP, Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, to disclose more than two decades of emails and correspondence with victims, whistleblowers, witnesses, and others. A Kansas City judge ordered SNAP to comply with lawyers because it had relevant information regarding two cases in Missouri. According to SNAP's national director, David Clawhessy, quote, the real motive is to harass and discredit and bankrupt SNAP while discouraging victims, witnesses, whistleblowers, police, prosecutors, and journalists from seeking our help. To talk more about this issue, we're joined today by the founder of SNAP, Barbara Blaine. Welcome, Barbara, to Law and Disorder.
Oh, thanks. I'm so grateful to be with you today.
Now, you're an attorney and, of course, I think one of the founders of SNAP. And we've covered SNAP before here on, you know, sexual abuse by priests and others. You know, you're 10,000 strong. You've been doing the work for years. But there's some recent developments that were really disturbing to all of us here at Law and Disorder. Can you just talk about what those are, what's going on?
Well, what's happening is that, as you know, we are a non-for-profit self-help support group run by and for victims of clergy sexual abuse. And we have been providing support information to each other since 1988. But what's happened now is that the church officials have taken an unprecedented move. This is the first time this has happened. And they have subpoenaed records from our SNAP leaders, and they've also sent subpoenas and did, in fact, depose our executive director of SNAP.
Tell us about where that occurred. In other words, you're a national organization. You have members who have been abused throughout the country. There's been a number of settlements by churches with regard to the crimes that were committed. And it's been going on for a number of years. But were these specific cities or towns, were the specific parishes, and what did they want from SNAP?
Well, here's the bottom line, is that you are correct that we are a nationwide group. Actually, we're now international. We have groups forming in other countries as well. But here in the United States, we have support groups meeting in about 65 to 70 cities. And in these support group meetings, people share their experiences, their feelings, and tidbits of information on how to cope with the repercussions of sexual violence. One of the things that we have learned along the way as victims is that it becomes empowering and healing for us if we can do something to prevent others from having to go through what we've been through, you know, like just accepting that we won't be able to know what it's like to grow up again without having been raped or sodomized as kids. So that leaves us in a position of being helpless, but we can kind of turn that around and be empowered if we can be a part of preventing another 12 or 13-year-old from having to endure what we have.
Give us a sense of what happened with these subpoenas now. Was this from, you know, if you can be specific, of what did they do to you?
Okay, so here's what happened, is that there's subpoenas from two different cities, from two different cases. They're both from the state of Missouri. The first one is from the Diocese of Kansas City, St. Joseph, and it's obviously in Kansas City, and in that city, what's happened there in the past year is that that a lot of sex abuse by priests has been uncovered and been exposed and brought to light. And in the process, the bishop himself was indicted for failure to protect children. There's been other indictments and there's other criminal cases, but the important thing is that in one particular civil case, the church attorneys have subpoenaed the records from David Clossy, our executive director, and from SNAP, and they are looking for very extreme information. These subpoenas are not tailored to actually get information that would be helpful for the case.
Well, SNAP is not a part of these cases, right?
That's correct. SNAP is not a party to either of these cases. In the case in Kansas City, the victim in that case has never talked to SNAP, never heard of SNAP. We've never had any contact with that individual. And what the church's excuse to the court as to why they should be permitted to subpoena our records is because they're claiming that the plaintiff's attorney may have violated a gag order on the court. And if that's true, if that's really what they were looking for, we question, well, why wouldn't you subpoena the attorney then? And if you're alleging or you fear she may have committed some kind of ethical violation, why aren't you taking that up with some ethics board or with the attorney registration board of Missouri? But instead, they're asking for these records, and they ask for records with no date from the very beginning of SNAP since 1988. They're asking for all the information in our emails, on our computers, in our files, and they're looking for any information from that names any priest from the city or from the Diocese of Kansas City, St. Joseph.
Barbara, this clearly seems like an example of a fishing expedition. We've seen this a lot when groups are effective in their work. And my question to you is, why do you think this is happening now? Why is SNAP being under scrutiny?
We suspect that there are three things happening. Number one is that SNAP is a client of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and the Center for Constitutional Rights, representing SNAP, filed a claim at the International Criminal Court in September of this past year. And the subpoenas arrived in October.
That's really interesting. And, of course, I know how amazing your trip to Europe was, to all the cities. I just want to say the ICC complaint was actually filed against the Pope and the Committee for the Doctrine of the Propagation of the Faith, if I recall. Am I right?
Right. It actually names four potential defendants. The issue is that would have implications across the world.
And in September, that ICC complaint was filed, and then these cases were filed against SNAP in subpoenas in October. Is that right?
Right. The following month, we received the first of the subpoenas. The second set of subpoenas came on January 2nd.
Barbara, there are two other reasons you were going to share with us,
right,
on why they're doing this now.
One is that the bishop himself, it's the first time a bishop has been indicted on these charges, and it was there in Kansas City. And while we in SNAP cannot and would never want to take credit for that indictment coming, we do believe that the victims who have courageously spoken out in Kansas City have had an impact. And I think it's empowered other victims to come forward, and so we think maybe they're trying to shut down SNAP in Kansas City. And the third thing is just the thing that I think you all said earlier, and that is that SNAP is having an impact and is making a difference, that they find that difficult.
Yeah, Barbara, you know what? When you were explaining the harassment that you're undergoing now, it reminded me of what happened when various peace and left-wing groups were suing the secret police, the FBI, the CIA, and so on, for harassment. The secret police turned around and did exactly what the Catholic Church is doing to you now, and we call it the problem of reverse discovery, where they try to bankrupt you and harass you the way the Church is doing to you now. But my question to you is, how are you fighting back? What are you doing about this?
The biggest concern we have is the fear factor that this is spreading. I mean, in many ways, the intended effect has already taken place, and we initially wanted to try to keep it quiet. And so we thought, we didn't believe that it would ever go this far, and we naively thought that the judge would see this for what it is, and that being this fishing expedition, that she would stop it early. So we hired a corporate attorney who we thought had expertise and recognition in the community, and thought that he would go in with us and point out how ridiculous these subpoenas were and just quash them. And unfortunately, that didn't happen. And when it didn't happen, you know, we had to file an appeal. We appealed to the appellate court, then also to the Missouri Supreme Court, where we filed a writ. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court determined that it really wasn't right, because the judge didn't compel David to turn over the documents or answer the question. So at a point in, I think, December, we realized that we were just going to have to go public with this, and we did, but we hated to do so because it really has an impact on many, many individuals. I mean, so many of the victims who contact SNAP many have not even told their spouses or their parents or their children or their siblings, and they really want this to be kept confidential. Some of the people who contact us are themselves whistleblowers. They work within the church, and they fear that they might lose their jobs if this information was made public. It's obviously embarrassing and painful information to talk about sexual violence, and victims want to maintain their secrecy or their confidentiality, and that's being threatened with these subpoenas.
Barbara, let's talk about the damage that this has actually done to the organization. You've spent, as I understand it, approximately $50,000 just in legal fees, along with devoting hundreds of hours of staff time since you received the subpoenas. To what extent has this interrupted your work?
It's interrupted our work on a huge scale. We devote most of our days to dealing with the outcome. It's that $50,000 is attorney's fees and then printing and copying fees as well. And those, surprisingly, are significant. We still are hearing from victims who are fearful. We've lost a couple of leaders over this who have asked that they don't want to be associated with anything going to the church. So they've asked to take their name.
We've got to wind it up now. What's your personal story in a nutshell about how did you get involved with SNAP?
First of all, our website is snapnetwork.org. How I got involved, I actually started SNAP, and I did so after I was raped and sexually violated by a priest in my parish growing up, and I didn't realize that it was abuse and thought it was my fault. And as an adult, I finally got some healing and recognized this and went to the church officials, but they really didn't help me. And at some point, I just realized I needed help and healing and thought, well, I'm not getting it from the church officials. And it was back in the 80s, and you remember there were self-help groups for everyone back then. So I just kind of thought, you know what, just find some other victims, and we'll find healing ourselves. Who needs them?
Amazing. Really, that's a remarkable story, Barbara. Barbara, you know, we've covered SNAP before, and of course, my office at the center represents you in many aspects of your work, particularly the International Criminal Court. It's really upsetting to hear the effect that this kind of abuse of lawsuits, not just of people, has done to the organization. So we just, you know, we wish you strength in the fight, and we were particularly pleased to see a New York Times editorial this week about the overreaching of the Catholic Church, rather than really come to terms with the and do something about the victimization of parishioners all over the world. They've chosen this means of dealing with it. Very, very sad.
Well, they've succeeded in it for a decade, so I guess they think they can continue to maintain their secrecy and cover it up. But we're doing our best to speak out, and we're so grateful for the support of CCR and also all of you and the chance to talk about it on your show. Thank you so much for having me today.
Thank you, Barbara.
Yeah, thank you, Barbara. Yeah.
Great, Barbara. Bye. Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Although over half of the population of New York City is Black and Latino, only 10% of its fire department reflect that fact. Last week, after 10 years of litigation, a U.S. district judge awarded plaintiffs back pay in a class action lawsuit that found the New York Fire Department to have racially discriminating hiring practices. U.S. District Judge Nicholas Garafis also ruled that the city of New York is liable for nearly $129 million in lost wages. The judge also ordered the Fire Department of New York to hire 186 Black firefighters and 107 Latino firefighters. To talk more about this victory, we're joined by co-counsel in the case, attorney Darius Charney.
Darius, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we're here to celebrate what is nothing short of an astonishing victory in court, a multi-million dollar payout for firefighters in New York City. Tell us briefly about the history.
So the history of this case and really this issue goes back, you know, to the late 1960s, early 1970s. At the time, you know, the New York City Fire Department was pretty much exclusively white male. At the time, you know, it was 95% white male. And so the Vulcan Society, which is the Black fraternal firefighter organization for New York City, brought a lawsuit in early 1970s challenging the hiring practices of the department as violative of the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution, saying that they racially discriminated.
One question,
yes,
as you get to that. This is 1970s.
Yeah.
New York City today is about roughly what percentage Black?
It's about 23-24%, you know, about 25% Latino. So, I mean, if you look at just Blacks and Latinos, it's, you know, over half of the city population. And, you know, as I can tell you right now that if you look at the fire department today, it's, you know, roughly, if you combine Blacks and Latinos, about 10%.
In a city that's almost 50%.
It's more than 50%.
More than 50%.
Yeah.
So go back. I'm sorry. Back then, it was probably roughly the same.
Yeah. So back then, I guess the city population was, I think, around 35-40% minority, but the department at the time was about 95% white. So the Vulcans sued to challenge the hiring practices, which, you know, they claimed were racially discriminatory. And a federal judge here in New York by the name of Judge Weinfeld found that, in fact, the hiring practices were discriminatory and violated the 14th Amendment. The Second Circuit Court of Appeals upheld that decision, and the fire department was ordered to make some changes in the 1970s, including developing a new, more valid and fairer firefighter civil service test. As it turned out, that never happened. There were, of course, some serious fiscal problems in the city in the 1970s, which the city used really as an excuse to say, well, we don't have the money to, you know, bring in an expert to develop a new test, and they just never did it.
Amazing.
So they kept really using this same test. I mean, you know, they altered it a little bit in terms of they came up with new questions, but the format and the skills and abilities they were testing continued identically to what was going on in the 70s right up until essentially this century, to 2006. And not surprisingly, the department's demographics never changed. And as of, you know, 2002, when we actually formally brought this case, you know, the department was about 3% black, 5% Latino, which is not much different than it was, you know, in 1970.
A city that's over 50%. Yeah. It was 10 years ago you brought the case. I didn't realize it was that long.
Yeah, so what happened is in 10 years ago, we represented the Vulcans and we filed a formal complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission in Washington, D.C., which is the federal agency that oversees enforcement of, you know, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 in employment. From there, you know, they investigated for a couple years. They found, in fact, that there was evidence to show that the test was discriminatory. They asked the city to sit down and try to work out a settlement, which the city refused to do for 2 years. So the EEOC referred the case to the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division. And this was during the Bush administration, which, you know, as you probably know, the Civil Rights Division didn't do much in those 8 years, but even the Bush Justice Department felt this was such an egregious example of discrimination that they decided to investigate and actually filed a lawsuit that we joined as co-plaintiffs in 2007. And so we've been in federal court ever since and have been very successful. You know, we've proven discrimination, I think, 3 times over now to the judge who's, you know, as you just mentioned, last week ordered a payment of $128 million to the black and Latino applicants who took the 2002 and 1999 tests, which the judge found were racially discriminatory and illegal.
Darius, in addition to the test itself, I assume that there are sort of informal mechanisms by which firefighters are recruited.
Yes.
Does the case talk about that at all?
It didn't originally, although we did bring it up with the EEOC, but we were not initially allowed to bring it up in the context of the federal court case. But last year, we had a big trial in the federal court in Brooklyn on you know, what relief the court should order because of the discrimination that was found. And one of the things we brought up and put in a lot of evidence on was the recruiting practices of the fire department, which we felt were also discriminatory and just inadequate. And, you know, we had a 3-week trial at the end of which the judge made a finding that, in fact, you know, in order to remedy this 40 years of discrimination, the fire department was going to have to make a better effort at recruiting, you know, people from minority communities to join the fire department. And so he has issued an order that specifically requires them to do certain things, including hiring an expert in recruiting diverse workforces. So that's something that's underway.
Darius, the history of the Bloomberg administration has been one of obstruction. What's going to prevent them from obstructing, doing a justice here?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I guess the first thing I would say is if you try to obstruct a federal court order, you know, that can lead to some serious penalties that the city could suffer, you know, financially as well as otherwise. In addition, I mean, I think from the city's perspective, it looks really terrible to essentially obstruct an effort to diversify your fire department. I mean, this is not something that I think is in any way, shape, or form controversial. I mean, we're talking about the least diverse big city fire department in the United States by far. I mean, it's not even close. And I think, as the judge has pointed out several times, it's really a stain on the fire departments, and it's an embarrassment to the city of New York. And so for them to obstruct it, I think, just looks awful.
I can't understand it, actually. I Bloomberg has been mayor for basically the whole period of the lawsuit. Mm-hmm. And they've never said, let's get this thing done. Let's get it settled. The figures are so awful for them in terms of discrimination. It's like, I'm just been shocked by the fire department since I've almost been in New York 30 years. But that Bloomberg has held it up like this. Do you have any understanding of why? And then I saw Bloomberg meeting with Obama the other day.
Yeah.
You know, at some, and I said to myself, what the heck is this? Obama's Department of Justice is suing Bloomberg for racial discrimination, and here he's with an African-American president, and this is going on?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know. You know, our clients, the Vulcans, you know, met with Mayor Bloomberg when he first came into office in 2002 about this problem. And, you know, he told them, he acknowledged it was a problem and said he was going to do something about it, and he just never did. And it's really hard to know why. You know, we took his deposition in this case, and he really didn't give a straight answer as to why, you know, they didn't make any effort to change a test or to look into different ways of making the hiring process more fair. But, you know, because of that, I think the judge decided that he had no other conclusion to make other than this must be, you know, purposeful discrimination on the part of the city, which, you know, is what we had been pushing and claiming all along. This was more insidious than just we have a test that happens to, you know, exclude people of color. We felt it was really a purposeful, intentional effort on the part of the city to exclude people of color.
Darius, in addition to the test into recruitment, can you talk a bit about what kind of discrimination, if any, exists within the ranks by other firefighters and how that is addressed?
Well, it's actually a fairly big problem, and has actually unfortunately increased since this case started. There's been a huge backlash within the department against not only the Vulcans as an organization, but against the lawsuit. There's an organization that has of fire officers that it's not officially sponsored by the fire department, but it is an organization of current officers that has been extremely outspoken against the Vulcans and the case, and has even been disseminating what we think are pretty defamatory faxes over the FDNY fax system about the Vulcans and the lawsuit and even the judge. This has been going on in recent months. You know, as well as, you know, there have been incidents, we think retaliatory incidents against Vulcans members for their, you know, efforts in this case. You know, most concerning to us is that the FDNY's Equal Employment Office has really dropped the ball in investigating and responding to these acts of discrimination. And that's actually something else the judge ruled last year when he ordered all of these broad changes. He said they really are going to have to revamp their Equal Employment Office to make sure it protects, you know, firefighters from discrimination.
You can see how easily it can happen. I mean, as I recall, fire department people live in the firehouse together for a period of 3 days or something, or whatever the number. Mm-hmm. And so then you have essentially whites, blacks, Latinos, and other people living together. And I think, I mean, it's just base racism at the bottom. I mean, I don't know how you see it.
Yeah, but I mean, I would agree, you know, and it's hard to argue otherwise. You know, the things that have been said about the Vulcans and the case, you know, go way beyond just I disagree with the legal arguments you're making. It's been very personal. It's been, as I said, very defamatory. That's really a problem when, in fact, these folks do have to live and work together under pretty stressful circumstances.
Well, that raises the issue of public safety and how that translates into firefighter morale and response to a fire. Is that going to be dealt with?
I mean, I hope not. I hope that doesn't become a problem. I mean, these are professionals, and I think, you know, I have a lot of respect for all firefighters. It's you know, it's a very tough job, physically demanding. It's not an easy job, and, you know, it can be a stressful job. And I know I can't do that job, but, you know, I've always found the FDNY to be extremely professional. But the fact that this kind of you know, discrimination and racial hostility exists in the department. And it's not just one or two firehouses. It's really throughout the department is really something that we're worried about. And we hope that, you know, with the court oversight and the changes to their equal employment practices, that it's going to be dealt with.
A question about monitors. Yes. Probably our listeners don't know much about what monitors are. Mm-hmm. But when I talk to you or the other lawyers on the case, they all talk about first it was one monitor, then two monitors, then three. Now we're up to how many monitors? Six monitors. So what is a monitor and what do they do?
Well, monitors are essentially, I would call them, I guess, assistants to the judge. In other words, you know, the court has to oversee a lot of different aspects of this case. There's a lot going on. There's a new test being developed, which actually is going to start, they're going to start administering it this week. So good luck to everybody who's taken the firefighter test. You know, so there's that piece. There's now the piece about the compensation for the plaintiffs. And then there's all these other changes that the judge has ordered, you know, that they make to recruitment and EEO and other things. And so since federal judges obviously are very busy and they have, you know, hundreds of cases, they have it going on at once, they can't really closely supervise all of these aspects of the case. So they appoint these monitors to essentially act in the role of the judge and to oversee each of these aspects of the case. So we have one monitor who is overseeing the development of the new exam. And many of you may know her, Mary Jo White. She used to be the U.S. attorney for Manhattan during the Clinton administration. She's been an outstanding monitor in terms of the test development. We have another monitor who's overseeing a lot of these changes to the recruitment and the EEO practices. And now we have four more monitors who are going to oversee the process by which the plaintiff class members are going to apply for money from that pot of $128 million, which is going to be a pretty complex process. So the judge felt he needed some help with that, too.
So tell me about the next stages, and then we can close. I know there's some appeals going on. A lot of it's actually already won a lot that's actually changed, like the new test, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But there's some things that Bloomberg administration have appealed.
Yes. So they appealed two things so far. They appealed the judge's 2010 ruling that they had intentionally discriminated against black candidates. So that case is going to be heard by the Second Circuit. We're in the process of briefing that issue. They also appealed.
Let me ask you a question about that. Here's the way I think I understand that. They gave a test that for 30 years kept keeping blacks and Latinos out. And so what the judge said is this is not just chance. When they saw this happening for 5 years, it's time to change the test. And if you don't change it and keep the same test that you know has results that are essentially making a police department that is not diverse at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, a fire department is not diverse at all. You're doing it intentionally. I think is that a summary of
that's pretty much it. I mean, I would add that not only did they know it was keeping blacks out, they knew that it wasn't a valid test. In other words, it didn't test the skills that you need for the job. And they were told that by the federal court in 1971 or whatever. So those two things together for, you know, 30, 40 years, I think are strong evidence that there's something else going on here.
Yeah, the second point is quite important. It's not just that it had a bad effects. Yes. It's that they actually knew the test was not a valid test.
Yes.
And the federal court had told them that.
Yes.
That's one of their appeals issue. And then, I know the Bloomberg probably really hates the idea that it was found intentionally
he hates
discriminatory.
And I'll get to him in a second because there's another piece of the appeal that deals specifically with Mayor Bloomberg. But the other thing that they appealed was the judge's ruling last year on these broad changes beyond just changing the test, you know, the changes to recruitment and EEO and other parts of the hiring process that the judge ordered. The city has appealed that. They say that that goes beyond the scope of what this case is about. You know, this case is just about the test, and so all remedies should be limited to the test itself. And so they've appealed that issue as well. And then the third piece that's been appealed actually by us is, you know, when we brought this case, we not only sued the city, but we sued Bloomberg in his individual capacity as the, you know, chief executive of the city government. And the district court did dismiss those claims on qualified immunity grounds, which is, you know, as you guys know, as lawyers, that's a legal concept that I don't know if we need to explain it, but we actually appealed that issue, so that's going to be heard at the same time as the claims that the city has appealed.
But basically, you've won something that has never happened in this city in 30 years, and it's
yes, and we hope that, you know, the city will at some point stop fighting, and because all the things that the judge has ordered in terms of changes, I think, benefit the fire department as much as, you know, our clients. You know, to have a more diverse department, to have a better test that's more accurately assessing people's ability, you know, to do better recruiting, to hire consultants to help you do better recruiting. It seems like those are good things for the fire department.
Darius, I noted recently that a record number of women have taken mm-hmm. the firefighters test. How do women factor into this discrimination, if at all?
Well, you guys may remember, since you've lived here in New York for many years, that there was a similar case brought in the early 1980s, because at the time the fire department had no women firefighters. So a group of women sued in the early 1980s, essentially alleging sex discrimination. And again, they pointed to the test and other aspects of the hiring process, and they were victorious, and the court ordered them to the fire department to hire 50 women, which they did do. But as with blacks and Latinos, that number has never risen since that time. And, you know, right now, I think there are between 30 and 40 women in the entire force of, you know, we're talking about 9,000 firefighters. So it's, again, a really small number. While that issue is not directly part of our lawsuit, it is something that I think we also are very concerned about. You know, there are several Vulcans members who are women, you know, and they've been very active not only with the Vulcans, but with the United Women Firefighter Association, which has been a big advocate of bringing more women onto the job. And with the most recent recruitment effort for the test that's going to be given starting this week, it is the highest percentage of women that have ever signed up, which I think is fantastic. You know, I think it took our lawsuit and the judge really closely watching the city to make them finally do a real bona fide recruitment effort. So, you know, we do have large numbers of women signed up, large numbers of black candidates, Latino candidates. So it's a good first step, I think, for the fire department.
So congratulations to you, to Richard Levy, to the Center for Constitutional Rights. How long have you been at the center for?
4 years.
And how much of your time now is spent on Vulcans and suing the city fire department?
It goes between this and my case against the cops. That's probably 100% of my time.
You have the stop and frisk case as well. Right. So you're really...
Me and the city law department are pretty close. So
congratulations on amazing work, Darius.
Thank you.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Yeah.